You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Eric Bogosian's play Talk Radio was first produced at the Public Theater 20 years ago and adapted into an Oliver Stone movie the next year, both starring the author. A new revival at the Long Acre Theater on Broadway stars Liev Schreiber as controversial late-night talk show host Barry Champlain. Ben Brantley of the New York Times, in his review of the play, calls him the finest American theater actor of his generation, and anyone who sees this production will probably agree. I'm very pleased that it has brought both the playwright and his star to my show today. Hello.
Hey, Leonard.
So Liev, you've gotten a certain amount of experience wearing headphones. You look very good in them.
Yeah, I was just noticing that you have a button here that says cough, which I don't have, and I want that button.
You're supposed to have that.
That's a good button.
That was
actually
in your
this
contract,
play.
Actually.
This play takes place during the time that these studios were built, and we had those cough buttons then. So I know it was very important to get the original equipment. That was one of the things that. Your set designer was adamant about
Mark
not making
Lindland.
It anachronistic.
Yeah.
Is it true that this collaboration began when the two of you met right here? You were being interviewed for different projects?
It seems like that was the first time we began to bond, was here. We had met other...
Should we give WNYC the credit?
Yes, we'll give WNYC the credit.
Publicist grabbed me and
right
said,
outside,
you know...
About 10 feet from here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's wonderful.
And then from that, I went to Glengarry and then backstage at Glengarry, I started to learn about how rude I was to Liev.
My connection to Eric goes back much, much further. I was in college studying theater, which was great. I really loved it. I thought theater was really fun, except it wasn't very cool. And I was looking at how you could write a serious paper about theater or how you could be considered a serious person by becoming an actor. And I was not feeling like that was possible. And I went into New York and I saw this guy, Eric Bogosian, who to me was kind of, I don't know, you know, for some, at that age, it was just how, it was how, you know, he was
Ricky D, wasn't he?
Yeah, Ricky Paul.
He was to theater to me what you know Johnny Rotten was to music, and I just thought that's really because I was really into Brecht too, and I was trying to find, you know, you do these productions of Good Woman of Szechuan that you know felt really you know avant garde and exciting, but it didn't really grab people by the cojones and. Here was somebody who really was, and he was topical, and he was really engaging and really kind of terrifying and hilarious and funny. So so I started to write about him. And then I auditioned for a play. He did a play. I was like, oh, great, the guy's doing straight plays now. I got a shot. And I went to Lincoln Center, and I think I just, like, you know, I fawned all over him and told him that I'd written my senior thesis about him. And I could see him sort of existential.
Nothing more boring than
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's right. No, I didn't get the job.
You got, from do you think you didn't give him the job because he was fawning, or did you just think somebody else might do
no,
it
No, he's
better?
Probably just mediocre. I think that was probably the problem.
Well, he's learned a good, lot since.
He's in good company. The people, among the people who didn't get roles in Suburbia, Phil Hoffman and other guys, I mean, it was just, it was an interesting thing to cast Suburbia because got to meet a whole generation of actors who, and basically a community, which has now, I've watched this community mature and become a very exciting community of people who are no longer young people, really. I mean, sort of, I don't know what you are. What do you call it? Young adult?
28.
Adult. You're 28, right?
Yeah. On radio.
Were you, when you met here, were you already thinking about reviving talk radio?
I wasn't thinking about it at all. Jeffrey Richards, who our producer, brought it up to me in a casual conversation last spring. And I had finally learned in my little career to not just say yes when somebody said, I said, give me the weekend to think about it. And I'm going, okay, there are a lot of things going on Broadway now that have opened the audiences, or maybe there is an audience for the Martin McDonagh work. There's a lot of stuff that's been there that isn't typical. Shining City was a different kind of structure, which Falls had directed last year. So, okay, I can see the play on a stage, But then who's going to play this guy? And I...
You didn't want to do it again?
No, I'm not. I'm not really equipped to play the role anymore. It requires a lot of focus, and it requires a certain amount of... Something has to be in your gut that's kind of a certain... Not just anger, but ambition. And at any rate, I thought about it, and I thought, well, I can only think of one person. And I said to Jeffrey on the Monday, I said, Liev Schreiber is the only guy I can think of who could do this. I had forgotten that Jeffrey had produced Glengarry, so he made phone calls and went through the process. And then I really also felt that the director had to be somebody who really understood my game and also understood Broadway at the same time. That's not so easy to find. And Robert Falls, I love working with Bob, and so we had the I felt with those two, put that together, and we had a chance.
Well, director is really important in something like this, because this could be very static. Much of the play involves you, Liev, sitting at a microphone, or two microphones in this case, and yet you got to do all sorts of stuff with body language. You've got to be able to have people move around that stage at different times. So it had to be done very cleverly. Still make it feel like you were really doing a radio show.
And I should add that when people come to see this production, Liev has had tremendous input to what you're seeing on that stage. I'm not going to be specific about, it happens that a line may pop out in rehearsal and you say it, but it's been much more than that. And it's been really great to collaborate in this way.
Well, since you wrote this play for your own voice, is it odd seeing somebody else do it and making it into quite a different performance?
Honestly, I don't even feel like it's me. To tell you, my voice, my play, I wrote this thing over 20 years ago. I'm a very different person today. And
much nicer, in fact.
And I don't know if that's a good thing, but the one point that always hits me, I just sit back, I just watch the play, and I love watching it, but there's a moment at the very end of the play, which if you haven't seen the play, I'm not going to spoil it for people, but it's a very, it's highly unusual theatrical moment, and every time I watch Liev do it, I remember what it was like to do that, and it's an incredible, there's nothing like it that I've ever experienced.
It has
on
to
a
be
stage.
Incredibly draining emotionally. You go through an awful lot of emotional changes through the course of the play, and
he likes it.
He
thinks it's relaxing
like it.
Something.
It's funny. There's a couple things with these kinds of plays, and I would put Glengarry Mamet's play in the same category. The rhythmic structure of it, the bones of it are sound, and so the thing kind of runs itself if you don't screw up too much, if you don't pause too much, if you don't indulge too much, if you let it ride. It has a rhythm. It has a speaker's rhythm, and I think because Eric is started as a solo performer and is kind of intuitive as a writer, that I get the sense from reading his stuff that he speaks it almost as he writes it. And so the pace of the thing and the rhythm of the thing moves very well for me. And it should also be said, too, I think, that, the callers are really the engine of the play. Barry is a sort of reactive role with this big at the end. And I,
which we're not going to reveal.
But the thing about that thing is ironically, it's actually people think, boy, that must be exhausting and horrible. It's actually kind of a nice little vent, you know.
My guests are Liev Schreiber and Eric Bogosian. We're talking about Talk Radio, which is currently on Broadway. Actually, Eric Bogosian's first play on Broadway, despite having so many plays performed. It's at the Long Acre. And we said there's that thing at the end. We can reveal that it isn't the thing at the end of the movie. Had you seen the original performance and the movie?
Yeah, both of them.
Now, the movie got changed an awful lot, Eric. You wrote the script, or at least you're credited with writing the script, but it's more melodramatic. What word do we want to use?
Earnest. It would be another word I would use.
Oliver Stone, really, is it as much his as it was yours at that point?
By editing, and he did it very slowly over time. First of all, there were three steps. First of all, there was the step of me saying to Ed Pressman, our producer, buy Alan Berg's story. There's no point in belaboring this, but the play has nothing to do with Alan Berg and never did.
He was a kind of a Lenny Bruce radio personality, very witty, very liberal in Denver, and he was killed by a white supremacist.
Right. He was murdered right in his front. He was machine gunned to death, and that happened in 1984. At the time I was writing the play, I saw a little article about it, and I thought, that's incredible, and I put it aside. I didn't think about Alan Berg anymore at that point. I just created this guy who has nothing to do with it. The only guy that this could ever have anything to do with is Bob Grant, who was on the radio, who I listened to a lot at the time, to sort of study his system of cutting people off and changing the subject and argumentation, etc. At any rate, when we were going to make the movie, I said to Ed, "Let's buy the Steven Singular book, Talk to Death, about Alan Berg, because the guy sounds like they sound like the same people, and there are things in this guy's story that are fascinating, like that he married the same woman twice. He married her, divorced her, and then married her again. Or one of my favorite things is that he showed up at a public event, and he had very high ratings. This is Alan Berg. Now we're talking about, and he assumed everyone was going to just love him, but in fact." People loved to hate him, and he got people were throwing things at him and stuff, and he was really chagrined that things were different out in the world than they were for him in the radio station, which has something to do with the radio station. So we built a backstory and thus the movie was this other stuff. The other thing that happened, there was an Oliver Stone movie. It was a movie, and so there were dramatic things that were brought in, especially the very violent ending, which I feel you can end the movie before you ever get to that, and that's where the play ends, and it's fine. It can end right there, and there's a nice ironic twist that happens at that moment. But the third thing, which I didn't see happening, was that as Oliver worked on the film, he would recommend that we remove a particular caller, and I'd go, okay, we won't do that caller. It'd be like one out of 25 callers. And then a week later, another caller would go. And then another caller would go. It was the callers who were going away that changed it a lot, because the play is funny, and the movie isn't funny. And the reason the movie isn't funny is that almost every one of the funny callers had been deleted, and more and more of the very stressed out and frantic. In fact, one was added who isn't in the play, a rapist who's going to go out and rape more people, and like you say, melodramatic.
Well, the comedy also comes from the fact that Barry Champlain is very witty, and that's part of his appeal as a radio talk show host. And in the film, we just have a guy who's kind of like angry and screaming. And some reviewers have implied that Barry seems almost tame now in comparison to some of the things that are out there today. Did you listen to some of the people just to get the rhythms, Leah?
Not much. You know, the rhythms, in a good play, the rhythms are in the language they're written in. You know, that's his job to figure it out. It's my job, you know, to do it. Interpret it.
I want to say, though, that in the course of this play and through rehearsals, Liev has developed a radio personality that I'm actually a little wowed by, because he modulates himself from the levels from being a really shrieking, crazed-sounding guy. Most of the time he sounds like a guy you want to listen to. And I don't know if you know you're doing this, but it's getting more and more... It's getting so professional sounding.
Yeah, you're going to get your
really
own talk show soon.
Well, we go to rehearsal. We care about the drama. We care about the moments. There's a lot of things going on out there, and that's what the audience is going to end up watching. But I'm also listening to this guy who, like, basically, you could switch the station and end up on the Liev show, and it would sound like a real guy.
I think one of my favorite elements of the play is that, and this, I think, is the big difference between, you know, films and plays that people generally just don't seem to understand, and it seems sort of wildly obvious, but in particular with this play, part of what I love about it so much is the layers of dialogue that are going on. There's a live show that's happening in real time in front of an audience in a theater that is also simultaneously happening in front of a radio audience, and there's a guy by himself in front of a live audience in a theater having a conversation with people over the air. And I think part of the appeal, and I think part of the comedy of that is the fact that it's happening in real time, and there is the pressure and the confines of that actual show, which of course you can't do in a film because you don't have that sense of it's really happening and we know we're going to go home in 2 hours. And I think that that also with an audience, and part of what's so much fun about doing this show is when you have a theater audience, unlike a cinema audience, they're also talking to each other. So that it's like, you know, when you study an audience reacting to a show, particularly on different nights, you feel different reactions to the show. There's all these different kinds of laugh. There's the sort of laugh of acknowledgement and recognition. There's the laugh of, I recognize that. Did you recognize that? There's the surprise, stumbling laugh of, you know, there's the laugh of, geez, I wonder if I'm actually going to go home with this girl who's sitting next to me if I laugh at this thing. And, you know, it's all that. And when that stuff sort of, when that's that communication between the audience and the play becomes symbiotic, it's really, really exciting. And I think this is one of those shows that does that because it has a real sense of real time. You are at that station watching that show go down. And as you know, there's a certain level of excitement to, we've got to get the programming in within a certain amount of time. And that in and of itself, I think, is fun for an audience. I think that's part of what's exciting about the play.
My guests are Liev Schreiber, who is starring in Eric Bogosian's Talk Radio, now on Broadway at the Longacre Theater. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Liev Schreiber, now starring in Eric Bogosian's play Talk Radio, and the playwright as well. And Eric, I know that when Suburbia was revived last year, you did a lot of rewriting. There were updates, including cell phones and iPods, and you talked about the war in Iraq. But this play is set in 1987. I knew some changes had been made because I have the original script here, but how much were you willing to change?
For me, it was, I looked at it like kind of, say you were going to take a 1970s muscle car and you wanted to really get it so that it really could perform on the track as well as any other car, but you don't want it to look any different. You still want it to look like that GTO or whatever. I wanted everything to look and feel the same. And a couple of the things even feel structurally a little old-fashioned. There's some monologues. I say old-fashioned, I mean 80s, because there was a lot of the things that had an effect on this play as it was being written are rooted in the theater world that I knew in the 70s, which was very downtown, whether it was Richard Foreman, Robert Wilson, the Performing Garage, a lot of things that I didn't want people to notice, but they're there. Just the very technical aspect. The show is very technical and meant not to be, the audience should walk in and not even think about it, but it's really complicated.
So you have people doing little monologues about their experiences with Barry Champlain to give us other aspects
right.
of his character.
Oh, there's monologues all throughout the show. I mean, there's also callers who call in who you would never leave on the air for. I mean, they talk about their garbage disposal for like 10 minutes, and it's all meant to be a pastiche, a montage of all kinds of flavors and sounds and. And then in the thick of it is this man writhing in it with his ego. But I did soup things up. I'll give you a really good example. When Barry first makes his entrance, he used to walk in and be talking about how he had accidentally phoned into a gambling hall where they bet on frogs. And it was a Chinese gambling hall. They had frogs, mice, and I don't know what else, weird things, weasels. And I just didn't feel like this is what I want. This guy, I wanted to walk in and make an impact. And honestly, speaking of Mamet, I don't want to give my secrets away, but what the hell? I admire David Mamet so much. The beginning of American Buffalo begins with when he walks in and he says, I can't even say the words because we're on the air, but Ruthie, Ruthie, Ruthie. And it's like, boom. So I wanted a boom. And then I thought, what's the thing that most upsets me in the world? And it's the traffic. And so I wrote this boom monologue for Barry to walk in. And
but it's exactly what someone would have said.
He's late. You know, yeah. There were things, as a dramaturg for my own work, I'm better at it than I used to be. It's like, oh, this guy's late. He was stuck in traffic. Let's move through all of that. And I'm probably a better writer today. I don't know that I'm a better idea guy today. So I love the ideas of the piece, but then I go back and I tinker with just the way words get put together. I'll notice that some character will say the word look twice in a sentence, and I'll say, you know, let's change it to gaze, and then I've got look and gaze going on. And it's very technical, and I just go over it. But it's the same play. It's the same arc, and the visit by the fan to the thing is, it was a eureka moment for me writing the play, because I that was what solved the play for me, was what would happen if somebody who was listening showed up and Barry finally saw, oh, this is what I've created, this is my listener. And Kent, but played by Sebastian Stan wonderfully every night.
Well, I can tell you, based on a personal experience, I used to do a Midnight to Five show on WBAI, and a listener showed up one night, and it was a disaster.
Yeah. Did you put him on the air?
I did. I put her on the air, yes.
Did you buy any weed from them?
That was the 70s. We were past weed, I think, at that time. Yeah. My guests are Eric Bogosian and Liev Schreiber. And we're talking about talk radio, which is now at the Longacre Theater. And I assume it's going to have a long run. Is this an open-ended run?
I believe we close at the end of June.
You have to go now. Start doing movies again and all that
stuff.
No,
I have to have a baby.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. You have to have a life.
Yeah, I'm going to have a child.
But ironically, I had my first baby when I was doing talk radio. And he's now in college. Yeah. But there's a lot of strange connections going on here.
Well, there are odd things that are happening in the acting world these mm-hmm. days, because Liev could be going off to do a movie, but he's also doing television. You're doing television, Eric. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing a lot more of that. First of all, we're seeing a lot of movie actors trying out on the stage. In the old days, it used to be you established yourself in theater and then you went into movies. And I guess, Liev, you did that the old-fashioned way. But we're seeing that reversed, and sometimes to disastrous results, because I suspect the techniques involved are so different. But here you're mixing three different things: movies, television, and then theater. In the end, do you draw upon the same acting chops for all three?
I think they all inform each other. That's the thing, you know. It's they are different skill sets, but I think that you know, a film acting really informs theater acting, and vice versa. And I think that the same is true for television. You know, I'm just glad that that people are coming back to the theater, and that it is sort of, it seems like a pretty exciting place these days.
And you said, Eric, that now people are willing to see something other than British musicals. What do you think has happened? Why do you think
there is a tremendous appetite for theater among a younger audience? Sometimes they can't afford to come. Something weird has happened to the theater scene in New York, which is it's actually more affordable to go to Broadway now for straight theater. That isn't like every seat is sold out months in advance. If there's any, then you have all this room to move. We have a student rush. We have all kinds of things going on. Off Broadway, once the show kicks in and it gets a good review or something, that's it. $65 a ticket, and you can just kiss all those young people out in Brooklyn or whatever who've just come to New York. They just can't afford to get in. My assistant stood in line for 3 hours to see Jack Goes Boating the other day for student rush at the Public Theater. There's a tremendous appetite. The theaters, I don't know. I mean, you know, there's sort of this rolling sine wave, whatever the thing is. I mean, you've got an audience that's building that does not have its feet firmly planted in the theater of the 1940s and want to basically relive that experience they had when they were six and they went with their mom and dad to see, I don't know what, Death of a Salesman or something. So now we've got an audience which needs to be to understand what makes it exciting to go in the theater, and that's theatricality, which may not always be a psychological trueness or just removing the fourth wall. Certainly our play has all kinds of weird angles to it like that, and most of the new plays have direct address. They have all kinds of, that is, the actors talk to the audience, all kinds of things that kind of jazz it all up. And I mean, I just imagine my sons walking into the theater, and I don't want to have to convince them that they should enjoy this or that this is like something like church or something. They either want to be there or they don't want to be there.
But it looked for a time, Liv, like the only young people in the theater were going to be on the stage. And now I saw Spring Awakening recently.
Yeah,
and
fantastic.
It was... There were few people over the age of 30 in that theater. So something wonderful is happening.
I'm going to take a little credit for talk radio here because after we finished Glengarry, and Glengarry, you know, broke a bunch of box office records for a straight play, and in a sense, we felt like we were it was a shot in the arm for dramatic plays on Broadway. Records, which, by the way, Eric is now broken with talk radio, but
when they have a cough button
to explain this, not in the play, but here in the studio.
No, but I'm going to have one by next week. I guarantee.
It's
the success of that play and the Tonys and all that, and people sort of talking about, well, what do you want to do next? I honestly have felt and still believe that this is a really, really ripe and optimistic time in the American theater. And I know people are always poo-pooing it. But I feel like, like Eric says, there really is an audience for theater now, and they're younger, which is surprising to me. And so I think we have a responsibility as actors, and I think particularly as producers of theater and as writers, to continue to create contemporary and vivid and exciting plays, because it's not, you know, and this is what I'm so excited about, and I guess why I like Shakespeare so much and trying to re-engage with that thing, is that this is not ancient history. This is, these plays are now and happening right in your face. And I think it's a little more obvious to people when you come at them with something as strong as talk radio or Glengarry, but...
One of the odd things about this play is it uses amplification in a way that seems appropriate. Too often when you see amplification in a Broadway production, it's because the actors can't project.
It
sounds artificial, but here you're using it to suggest on air and then you're not amplified when you're off air. And that's using it to a real positive effect.
In terms of what we were talking about before, about how cinematic acting can inform theatrical acting, I can't think of a better example than this play because of the microphones. And that's very exciting to me because it, in a certain way, it opens up a whole new window of opportunity for theater and thinking about it. I mean, you know, mic'd stuff is weird. In our play, it works because it's a conceit of the play. But the kind of nuanced work you can do with a microphone an inch away from your face is just amazing. And I think that that's part of what makes talk radio so interesting, is you get to see a subtler, kind of more internalized and, I don't know, idiosyncratic style of performance that's not so easy when you're playing in front of a house of 1,000.
Barry is incessantly taking mood-altering substances throughout this play. Coffee, Jack Daniels, smokes a lot of cigarettes, snorts a little cocaine, and then washes it all down with Pepto-Bismol. But when he talks into the mic, he still sounds smooth and in control. He is not as much in control when he's off mic. But you physically, we see that it's having an effect on him. And I think about actors doing that sort of thing and having that kind of control. And is this something that just happens, or are these things that you actually have to work out in rehearsal to make it seem credible?
I think that's a performer's thing. You know, I remember watching, and I hope I don't, you know, say anything out of line here, but I remember watching Richard Burton perform. I think Barry is a natural performer. Do you know what I mean? And I also think that Barry is probably an alcoholic and a drug addict. But those people are functional, and I'm sure you've met them, that they are completely functional. In fact, the reason that they do it is because it heightens their ability to do what they do. And I think so that's part of what happens with Barry. I think Barry could go on drinking Jack Daniels and snorting cocaine and taking barbiturates all night. What he can't ultimately do is he tops up with feeling. And I think that for me, part of what I love about the character and part of what I love about what Eric's written is that Barry is kind of an empath, And what he's doing is he's absorbing the chaos and the insanity of the callers. And I think that's the one drug that ultimately he can't handle.
He's incredibly smart, but he's also incredibly screwed up.
Yeah.
Well, there's at the end of the day, the play is hopefully, for me anyway, it's about really the heart of being a performer, a person who is addicted to their audience. And we understand it because that's what we do. There are moments in the play where he tells the audience he hates them. And, you know, we have a guy sitting on stage telling the audience out there, I hate you. Who else could he be talking to? There's a thing where we need it for our self-definition, and yet we sometimes resent it, that we are hooked to this thing. And I remember the first time I got applause at the end of a play. It was like... I never shot cocaine, but it's what I would imagine shooting cocaine would feel like. It was, and it suddenly I was affirmed as a person. Here was, and I wanted more, and I went back. Eventually, I hit a crisis in college where I realized this can't be the reason why I come to do theater every day. If I do it for this reason, it's going to kill me. But it was always part of it. And writing this, when I was writing this, I was in a moment of deep crisis in my life, and. I had reached a point where it kind of was happening and not happening at the same time. And I thought, well, how far, what am I willing to do to get that audience? And I think that that's part of what goes on with this man, except this man has no capacity for self-reflection. That's the, you know, is Barry me? Barry is me, yes, in a lot of ways, except that I spent all my time worrying this bone. This guy seems to be, and like many people I've met in the business, doesn't even notice that this is happening. And then, you know, one day they show up OD'd on the bathroom floor or whatever has happened to them.
Yeah. I had the same crisis. I never really got over it, though. You got rid of it in college.
I didn't get rid of it. That's amazing. I just...
It started for me in college. I was doing a monologue from Drinking in America. It was the first time anybody ever applauded at me or laughed at me.
Stalking me.
And I thought, yeah.
But I have to tell you, it's even for non-performers, it works that way. I've done live broadcasts in front of audiences, and I remember one time Nadine Gordimer, who I think of as this very serious writer, and she said something that got a laugh, and suddenly she was going for laughs. There's something about working before an audience. In fact, and I can't remember who it is, but some actors, some playwright. Oh, yeah, it was Tom Stoppard, who said if he doesn't get laughs during a play, he feels that he hasn't connected to the audience. So,
well, it's a strange thing about what's happened to the theater that you almost can't do a drama now unless you have comedy in it, and you've got to keep pulling the audience towards you with the humor so that they'll want to keep listening and stay engaged with the play. I mean, we can say what we want about, you know, the great O'Neill plays, but write something like that today and see if it gets past the second workshop.
On the other
reading.
Hand, Shakespeare gets a lot of laughs, doesn't he?
Well, yeah,
he gets
cool.
A lot of laughs,
except in Lear.
You know, that's one level of the performance. You know, and I think that if you stop there, you're in trouble. And I think that what the laughs do, laughs are like meat tenderizer to me. You know, it's like that's what it does, is it sets them up to get caught. It loosens them up, and it sets them up to get involved with you. You know, first they're deciding whether or not they identify. They let you know that they're identifying with a couple of, you know, chuckles. And then you catch them with a couple of good laughs, and then they start to really open up. And the point is, what do you do with it then? That's really what's interesting. That's what makes a play good, and I think that's what makes a performance good, is once you've got them moving emotionally, which is what laughing does, where do you go then? And you have to be willing to keep sticking it in. You got to keep going. You got to top it and move through it. You can't sit back on it. If you sit back on it, it just becomes passive, and you kind of walk out feeling like you're high on helium or something.
Yeah, it took me a while to realize that I actually don't know how to write comedy. I would write things that were funny, and then I would get assignments to write something funny and fail. I mean, things that no one's ever seen or heard about, movies, TV shows, and so forth. I have this weird part of me where I'll write the most serious thing I can, and then it'll have laughs in it, and then I won't even know where they are until it gets performed, and go, oh, is that I guess that's funny. And I guess part of it is the identity part of it. Or so we really push with this production, and we go over this again and again with the whole company, that we have to understand what's the story we're telling. What's, you know, stick with character. Don't worry about those laughs. They're going to come. They're not going to come. We get them. But it's the honesty, which I think is part of what Liev's saying, of understanding, are we really understanding what we're saying to each other? Then the audience will understand, and then they'll hook in or
not.
I
also think that if you layer it right and rhythmically you keep it going, what happens is they don't realize what they're laughing about until it's too late. And then essentially they're feeling the same thing that Barry's feeling at the end of the play.
You've connected them to their to the character. I'm having so much fun. I wish we could go on forever, but we have run out of time. Thank you both so much for being with us. It's been a real pleasure. Eric Bogosian, Liev Schreiber. Talk Radio is now at the Longacre Theater. Eric has finally made it to the big time instead of just being a downtown artist. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I hope... and the next thing for you, you say, is being a father.
I think so, yeah. Little project I'm working on.